I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Claudia Cornwall joins me again. The award-winning author has just published British Columbia in Flames, Stories from a Blazing Summer. It takes us back to 2017 and that summer when it seemed like the province was on fire. The smoke got us here in Metro Vancouver. It was thick in the air. But in communities seriously and closely affected in the province's interior, up near Ashcroft, Cache Creek, 16 Mile House, Quesnel, Williams Lake, Clinton, and places in between, including Sheridan Lake, where Claudia has a cabin that's been in the family for over 60 years, it was often dire. There were volunteers fighting fires throughout. It was frightening as evacuations were being conducted. There were some who wouldn't go, as well as the Bonaparte First Nations community who knew better and didn't leave. Ms. Cornwall gathers many of their stories through interviews she conducts, giving us a sense of the danger as well as a sense of community that emerged. In this time of COVID, it's good to remember when people could help one another without being distanced physically. I'll ask Claudia, too, about the environmental future as fires across the planet seem to be on the rise. We talked a couple of weeks ago when the smoke was thick in the air again due to fires in the United States. Claudia Cornwall's previous books include Battling Melanoma, Catching Cancer, Letter from Vienna, A Daughter Uncovers Her Family's Jewish Past, and At the World's Edge, Kurt Lang's Vancouver, which she was on this program with in 2011. She is a recipient of the Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize and taught creative writing at Simon Fraser University for many years. This new book is from Harbor Publishing. She joined me from North Vancouver. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Claudia Cornwall. Ms. Cornwall, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
What was it about the 2017 fires that were particularly destructive? I mean, could you give us an overview as to just how much damage was done?
Oh, yeah, a lot of damage. I mean, 1.2 million hectares were burned, and that was significant. We lost maybe $6-7 billion worth of saleable timber. Mills shut down because of lack of supply. The tourist industry in the Caribou was affected. I mean, people couldn't get here and were deterred from coming back. So it's been a very destructive force. Some people, we lost structures, we lost houses, cottages. I know people whose cottages were completely destroyed. I know one fellow who, everything was gone, even the aluminum boat that he left on his dock was melted. And he's at Pressy Lake, which of course was very badly affected. And he's in the unfortunate position that the zoning rules have changed, which makes it really difficult for him to even rebuild. And I think he's given up and he's going to, just see if he can sell the property because he can't put the cabin as close to the lake as possible as he used to have it. And then when he puts the septic field in, it has to be back further, and it looks like it would end up in the road. And I mean, it's just endless. So I mean, his life is just not going to be the same. And this was a much beloved cottage that his father started building, 60 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And so those kind of stories, are really heartbreaking. So there were losses that some people will never really recover from.
Right. Is it a safe observation, Claudia, to make that wildfires have happened more often than in the previous years, say? I mean, you have a cabin at Sheridan Lake. That's been in the family for 60 years.
Yes.
Have there been fires in that part of the world prior?
There have been, but I don't think they were as destructive. I mean, there have never been any fires close to our cabin. In 2017, the fires came to within a kilometer of our cabin. We've had fires before, but they were all, kind of some distance away, and we weren't particularly, concerned about them. But I think the fires of 2017 were more destructive. I mean, they were, we had the biggest fire that we've ever had in the province's history, the Plateau Fire, which is about 500,000 hectares just in itself. So I think they've been getting bigger, more destructive. That doesn't mean we get them every summer. Of course, this summer has been kind of moderate as far as fires go, but the danger hasn't passed. And it's a combination of climate change and our forest management practices that, have contributed to this situation. People say, for example, that in Penticton, they did actually do some things about cleaning out the forest, and that helped them to fight the fire that came this year. But we have a big province and lots of acreage that needs to be treated, but it's partly an effect of climate change because the pine beetle thrives in warmer conditions. The beetles come in, they kill the trees fall down, then they're on the ground and they're just tender. The warmer conditions also produce, bigger storms, so more blowdown. And then lightning, when I was writing my book, BC in Flames, I learned that, lightning is more common in warmer conditions, so 12% more likely, than it used to be. So, then you've got the spark as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've just got all these perfect, all these conditions that make for worse fires. So I think it's something people in California, where, they live even more in the interface than we do. But we live, a lot of people have cottages and homes close to fires, close to trees. British Columbians love trees.
Yeah,
like to be near them. And so, you've got this, perfect situation for a fire.
Yeah.
So, it's a big risk for us, I think. I mean, every place it has different risks in terms of climate change, but for the interior of BC, fires are definitely a big deal. And it also means, some people can't get insurance anymore.
Sure,
because,
right,
and our insurance was doubled.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, about $1,000, it's $2,000. I mean, and some people just can't afford that. And so, it's kind of a cascade of bad things happening.
Well, we'll talk about climate change in just a sec. But you mentioned the forest practices or forest management practices here in British Columbia and cleaning the forest floors. I mean, we've heard the President of the United States talk about sweeping. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what he means, right?
Well, that's kind of an exaggeration. You're not going to sweep the forest floor, but he's got a point, except he doesn't acknowledge that, the root cause of that. Well, there are two things that are happening in the forest. I mean, one thing is definitely climate change because it kills the trees. More trees are on the ground, and so you have to deal with that. One of the things I learned when I was doing this book is I looked at what some people suggested I look at how Sweden manages its forests. And one of the things they do is they have quite an active pellet industry. So they, all this, garbage wood or waste wood that's on the floor, has value because they collect it for pellets.
Mm-hmm.
And then they use those pellets. This reduces their consumption of fossil fuels. It means that this wood on the ground has value, and so people collect it.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps their forest floor cleaner. So I think, I don't like to say that Trump is right about anything, but
I think
he is right about that. He just doesn't acknowledge the cause of it, which is really more than anything, probably climate change. The other thing, we've been very, very zealous about, many people talk about this too, that we've been very zealous about, putting out all fires. And if you put out even small fires, sometimes small fires can go in, take out the brush, take out this undergrowth, kind of clean up the forest. The big trees with thick bark survive. And so it's kind of but we've been pretty zealous about not, putting out all fires. And so this hasn't, we haven't had this, had this cleaning fire for some years. And the First Nations, of course, are well known for having done that in the past, that they would, burn on a fairly regular basis. And they had people who were pretty expert at it so that they could burn in a safe manner. And they would burn around their villages, partly to make space for the plants that they wanted to encourage, like berries and certain medicinal plants, and partly to, that there'd be a space around their village so that they could see that he was sneaking in.
Yeah.
They were visible. And so they, had a burning practice, which we kind of, we forbade, actually, this was, not allowed. And now people are sort of coming back to it and saying, well, maybe we should do some prescribed burning as well to, you know, clear out the forest and, you know, make sure that, you can do it in a safe manner. That's key. You don't want to start a big forest fire just, you know, because you're trying to clean away a bit of brush. But
you mentioned Sweden a moment ago, and there's a lot that we could learn from them. In terms of the sort of species that are planted in British Columbia, I mean, could that change perhaps?
Well, that's another thing, I think. I mean, there's been, people have been saying that we've had people clear cut and then there was a monoculture and they would, you know, plant all pines, because this is the most valuable species, but it's also the most, it is the one that burns really hot and is very flammable. And so there's some thought now we should also encourage, you know, have a more patchwork type of forest, which is probably more natural, where you have some aspens and some poplars and alder. These trees don't burn quite as readily, and so, and some people even say, you know, an alder forest is an asbestos forest.
Yeah.
I don't know that's quite true, but that doesn't burn as readily, so that could be protection. Another way to get kind of diversity and protection, and also, you know, having we saw with the pine beetle. I mean, one of the reasons we've, you know, overplanted pines, and then when the pine beetle came in, there was many hectares that were vulnerable to the pest. So, if you can have more diversity, then if you do have a pest come in, they're not going to take all the trees. We lost so many trees to the pine beetle. And the pine was planted even in areas which were perhaps not even its natural habitat.
Mm.
You know, it kind of extended the range beyond what was natural for it. So, yeah, so I think a more variety of species, more diversity, more diversity of age. One of the problems if you clear cut, too, is that if you clear cut and take everything out, then everything, and you replant, then everything's going to be the same age. And some insects, like the pine beetle, was particularly hard on older trees. So if you have if all your trees are the same age, and you get a pest that's, you know, particularly, aggressive on that trees of that age, then you're going to lose the whole bunch. But if you have, you know, a variety of age as well as the species, these are all protective measures, I think, that, you know, we have to, I think is worth, you know, doing.
Yeah.
To kind of protect ourselves from the possibility of catastrophic fires. I think we're not going to eliminate fire from our landscape, but what we want to do is make sure it's not catastrophic and that it doesn't, you know, threaten our community.
Well, one of the fascinating things is the marvelous stories that you tell in the book, that living here in Vancouver, as I do, I don't realize that a lot of small communities throughout the province can't afford to have full-time fire departments.
And they have volunteers, and some of the volunteers are, some of them are paid, some of them are not paid. I know that in Ashcroft, which had a very dangerous fire, they were paid $7 an hour, the volunteers. So,
yeah.
I've talked to the fire chief in Hundred Mile, Roger Hollander. I mean, he said, well, you know, we really need to professionalize our firefighters. I mean, the volunteers are great, but, we don't expect our surgeons, we don't expect our pilots, to be volunteers. We expect them to be professional. It is becoming a more, it's not an occasional thing that you do if you're a volunteer firefighter. You would be called on quite a bit. So, it really seems to me that you want to professionalize the force the idea of just doing it for nothing, and it's so dangerous sometimes, seems crazy to me. People should be paid.
Yeah, and you talk to a lot of these volunteer firefighters in the book. It's fascinating to see what motivates them to do that.
They want to protect their communities, and that's how, you know, originally it all started, these volunteer fire departments that they, are people who want to, protect their communities. And there was, I mean, in 16 Mile House, they didn't even have, they had people who were firefighting, And they had very resourceful people in the Caribou are very resourceful and ingenious. And they had converted, they had made their own tenders, their own vehicles capable. They would put tanks on pickup trucks and so that they could deploy locally without, but they don't even have, like, they don't even, like, if you go to some communities, it'll say, you know, there'll be a fire hall and it says volunteer fire department and all this. This community or these people at 16 Mile House, they're just, they don't even have that. I mean, they don't have a fire hall. They don't have a fire engine. They made their own tenders, and that they were able to put out some fires in the 2017 fires. I mean, there was one lady I talked to who had a ranch near 16 Mile House, and the fire came in, and it was this troop of, you know, five or six yeah. guys in pickups who put the fire out and saved her ranch. So, they don't get paid at all. And they did get a modest, I think, a local mining company gave them, money to have a good pump.
Yeah,
but they really don't, you know, they don't get any money so that's this community that's really, you know, that is volunteer for sure. And just because they want to, you know, protect themselves, protect their neighbors.
You mentioned the resourcefulness of the people themselves. I mean, it reminds me of a number of stories in the book as to just how clever and how people stepped up to, I mean, you talk about in the book about this, I guess they were making wine in Clinton.
Oh yeah. In Clinton there was a couple there who, they were winemakers and they thought, oh, well, this fire is coming in and we want to protect our place. So again, they made their own tender. They just used their pickup and they had a lot of fermentation vessels. So they filled those all up with water and put a pump on their pickup hooked up to a generator and away they went. And their idea was that if there were embers or whatever, small little fires that landed, that they could put them out. Their place survived. So, people were pretty ingenious about that and just sort of making do with, you know, not a lot of help from, you know, from authorities or whatever, just doing it on their own.
After writing this book, Claudia, did you get a sense of how British Columbians are in a crisis? I guess you do. I certainly did as a reader.
Yeah, well, it was a very, very, I thought they performed really well. I mean, there was, for example, the evacuation of Williams Lake. I mean, you had 10,000 people evacuating from Williams Lake. And I think that was like amazingly well organized. I talked to people there who said there was no road rage. There was no no untoward incidents. I think one person fell asleep driving because it was a very slow kind of exodus.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I mean, you had 10,000 vehicles, leaving Williams Lake, and it was really a smooth, I mean, and people carrying all kinds of stuff. I mean, they had their trucks. They had, in some cases, horse trailers and animals with them. And I mean, it was quite an exodus, but people behaved very well. And there was, you know, they just followed instructions and got to their destination. And that was a case. One kind of neat story there is the exodus of Williams Lake. They came, some of them went north, but most of them came the southern route, so they came south to, south down Highway 97 and turned in at Highway 24 and went over to Little Fort. And the store in Little Fort, they knew that all these people were going to come, and the lady who ran the store said, oh, I'm just going to make, I know they're going to be hungry, I'm just going to make a bunch of sandwiches. So she just made sandwiches until 3 or 4 in the morning and handed them out. And people said, you know, do you want me to pay for this sandwich, or what do I owe you? And she says, oh, no, take this sandwich. You know, it's just like, so people are very helpful. And you know, things like another interesting story was the evacuation of horses from Williams Lake. So there was a woman, Lana Shields, who turned the Stampede Grounds in Williams Lake into a sort of a temporary a shelter for horses that were in the fire, and she welcomed, and she did this all by Facebook, and she said, you know, the Stampede grounds are open if you want to bring your horses in. And then they realized, of course, that Williams Lake was going to be evacuated, and they had to get the horses out from there. So then they organized a, you know, a kind of, you know, exodus of the horses, and asked for volunteers to come and, you know, take the horses to Prince George where it was safer. And all of this done all through, you know, Facebook and messaging and texts and all this, you know. And it was just like nobody was kind of running the organization in a kind of formal sense, but they were all coordinating and cooperating and sort of doing the right thing. And she said, you know, even the horses were well behaved. She said, sometimes horses don't like to be with other horses,
right,
or, you know, because they're other horses, whatever, they don't know them, and so they'll bite and fight. And she said, no, there was no fighting. The horses were great. No, they were great. The people were great. Everybody really cooperated really well and just pulled together and were, you know, super sensible. And I think, you know, I talked to people, afterwards, and there was this tremendous, you know, sense of community. And I think, you know, that was, you know, people almost missed it. I mean, Sven Nielsen, who was the head of the RCMP detachment in Hunter Mountain, he said, you know, he didn't wish the fires would come back, but he kind of missed that, you know, sense of camaraderie that he had with the people, and how everybody kind of was sensible and helped each other out. That was kind of, you know, we missed that. And one of the things in the fires, of course, you could hug people. We can't do that now. We got this COVID, you know, and we got a crisis. But, you know, it's in some ways it's harder on human beings, I think, to go through a crisis like that and not be able to have that kind of, you know, primate type hugging.
I read the book in the spring, and it was almost nostalgic, you know what I mean, and then thinking about, well, if this happened today, how would it work?
It would be really tough. I mean, because people were opened their doors,
right,
you know, like when people were evacuated, I mean, there were people who said, you know, would open their doors to strangers and say, well, you can stay with me. And, you know, you wonder if that's a good idea, or you have to social distance and you have to have all these other calculations, and all the evacuation centers that we had where people were put up, you know, for shorter or even longer periods of time. I mean, how you do that, how you, you know, make sure it was safe from a COVID point of view. And I don't know. I mean, that certainly, I mean, they're struggling with that in the United States. They have to, you know, make sure that, you know, they have to do these evacuations and everything, and also social distance. And you can imagine for the firefighters too. I mean, how do you fight a fire and have to worry about social distancing at the same time as you're, you know, maybe trying to help someone lug a hose somewhere, and you got to be 6 feet apart. I think it would be very difficult.
I want to talk about climate change, and one of the things that struck me as I was reading the book is we don't realize the role that forests play in the climate crisis, and the role that they could play for good, right?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I was amazed by this myself to learn that, you know, in 1990, BC was our forests absorbed enough carbon to compensate for their own emissions. I mean, forests emit a certain amount of carbon too, and wood rots and that sort of thing. But they compensated for that, and they also compensated for all the emissions that British Columbians had through the burning of fossil fuels for transportation and industrial processes. So in 1990, British Columbia was carbon negative. So we absorbed more carbon than we and, you know, than the citizens and the forests and everything put out into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And now, of course, with the forest fires, you know, the carbon, you know, there's so much carbon that goes into up in smoke. That's no longer the case. And, so we're the forest, and they're, you know, they're also, you know, because of a pine beetle, they're not as healthy. And so for various reasons, they're not able to sequester as much carbon, but they're a tremendous resource. I mean, not just for British Columbia, of course, but for the world, we have the potential. If you think, you know, in 1990, we were carbon negative, we could assist the world, which desperately needs some, you know, sequestration. And I know we have these projects, like there are projects in Saskatchewan to sequester carbon dioxide underground, but I think the forests do a better and safer job of it.
The other thing that I enjoyed as I was reading the book, obviously, are the stories of the people. And you have this marvelous ability to draw people out, and you can tell that through the conversations you've had for the book. Might you reflect on your abilities to ask people about their experiences, especially these are very stressful times? I'm wondering, do you approach those conversations differently?
Well, I think one of the things that helped me was the fact that we have a cabin here. And so some of the emotions that, you know, some of the people went through, I had gone through myself. And, of course, it's a cabin. It's not my, you know, it's not my home. I live in North Vancouver, and I do have another place to go. But I think that, you know, made me, and we'd had this cabin for 60 years, and so I was kind of like almost a local. And so that helped me, I think. I sort of got the foot in the door, whereas maybe somebody, you know, who had really no experience of the caribou and might not be accepted in the same way. But I found people were welcoming, and I really wanted to hear their voices. I wanted to hear, you know, their take on all of this. Mm-hmm. And I guess they got that. I wasn't trying to, you know, put my city views on anything or impose anything. I just wanted to, you know, get their stories. And you know, once they realized that, they were happy to talk. I mean, sometimes, you know, there were people who didn't want to talk. I mean, there are some people who, you know, they feel they don't want to, like, draw a lot of attention to themselves. They don't want to boast.
Sure.
They're quite, you know, modest, and so they might think it's a bit unseemly. Like, people in the city love to be interviewed. But, you know, in the country, you know, some people, they, you know, they're kind of, you know, want to. But anyway, enough people were willing to, you know, tell their story. And maybe even that sometimes helps. It was a very stressful time, but kind of going over it like that was maybe a way of, you know, processing it. And dealing with it also, so maybe to get something out of it that way as well. But I think you have to approach it with some respect and sympathy. So I think that was helpful, but certainly definitely having some kind of local connection, and so I would know. So in some cases, I knew people who would, you know, be willing to tell me stories and knew something about it, but had been through it, you know, a little bit myself. Not, you know, we didn't lose our place.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, you know, wasn't as extreme a situation as some, but at least I had that sympathy, and I had sat there, you know, watching the internet and watching the fires go north and thinking, oh God, what's going to happen to our place? So I had some feeling of empathy with everybody. And I guess that came through when I talked to them.
It's an invaluable book because it's a lot of history that otherwise would not have been documented. I so enjoyed talking to you. Again, congratulations on the book, and I hope a lot of people pick it up.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Joe. Thanks for your interest, and I enjoyed talking to you, too.
The book is called British Columbia in Flames, Stories from a Blazing Summer. It is published by Harbor. Its author, Claudia Cornwall, joined me on the line from North Vancouver in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.